Welcome to the Issue Is podcast on this Memorial Day weekend. This week, we had an opportunity to have four one-on-one interviews with four strong, independent, newsmaking women from different perspectives, different generations, different point of view. No, we're not talking about The View, and no, I'm not Barbara Walters in 1997. We're talking about Senator Kamala Harris, who's running for president, Gloria Allred, who is such an important activist when it comes to the issue of abortion rights and led major protests this week, Tommy Lauren, who had a very newsmaking commentary on the issue of abortions, and Jennifer Siebel Newsom, the first partner of California. So during this podcast, we're going to have an opportunity to play those interviews in full, including some material that had to be cut for TV because of time, but the advantage of podcasts is I don't have to do that. So we begin with Senator Kamala Harris, who, of course, is one of the leading presidential candidates. We spoke at Southwest College. And right now, polls show her sort of in the middle of the pack, kind of part of the top tier, but trying to take it to the next level and hopes that California will help her do that. So here is our conversation with Senator Kamala Harris. Harris, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Alex, it's good to be with you.
Good
Thank
to see you.
You.
Okay, so the last time that we talked, I asked you to blink if you were running. You blinked. A couple days later, you ran. And since there's been a whole lot of other people that have also been running, I guess they're all blinking too.
Yeah.
The most basic question is, why you of all of them?
Well, listen, first of all, I think that we are at a point in the history of our country where we want leadership that's about lifting people up and not tearing them down. I have a proven track record of leadership, both at the local level, as an elected leader in the local level, state level, and federal level. I have a proven track record of knowing how to fight and win. And, you know, ultimately, I know how to successfully prosecute the case against the policies of this administration, policies that have been about tearing families apart at the border, policies that have been about giving tax breaks to the richest people in our country and the biggest corporations in our country and not helping the middle class, policies that have not been about building up infrastructure but have in fact been about putting money in the back pockets of the richest people in our country. So I'll tell you, I think that having traveled the country and certainly been elected three times statewide in California, that I have a good sense of where we are, and I think there is no question that in the next president of the United States, we want a commander-in-chief who understands how to appreciate and respect her power and how to use it in a way that is in the best interest of the American public and not self-interest.
It's good to have you back home in California.
I'm so happy to be home.
California's never meant more to the presidential election because it's moved up.
Yes.
You have an extraordinary number of statewide elected officials who are endorsing you.
Yes, I'm very honored.
Polls show you're not in the lead here right now. Why do you think that is, and where do you prioritize California with your larger electoral strategy?
Well, listen, I mean, I am a very proud daughter of California, and I am very proud and honored that the state of California and the people of the state have elected me three times as Attorney General, re-elected me as Attorney General, and as a member of the United States Senate. And I'm going to fight to earn the vote of every Californian on the issues that they care about. And that is about what we need to do around the economy and lifting people up. It's going to be about what we do to pay teachers. It's going to be about what we do to fix the immigration system and pass comprehensive immigration reform with a pathway towards citizenship. There is so much work to be done. And I think that California has always been a leader around what the future can look like in a way that includes everybody. And I'm going to be campaigning up and down our state like I always have to earn every vote.
One of the most important issues to a lot of Californians is reproductive rights, which is so important to you as a potential first female president.
That's exactly right.
What we're seeing around the other states are these laws limiting abortion. How should California respond? Should Hollywood boycott these states? Should there be a travel ban from California? What should California do in response to what's happening?
Well, I'll tell you what I've been doing. I've been asking my supporters to support the advocates who are on the ground in those states to make sure that the women of those states have access to health care and reproductive health care. I've been asking my supporters to support the advocates who are not only advocating on behalf of those women, but also pushing through the lawsuits in a way that we can protect a woman's right to choose. There is a lot of work to be done because we understand that a woman's right to choose is under vicious attack in our country. And we cannot turn back the clock on this. And I just want to be perfectly clear, Alex. Everybody has a right to choose. Mm-hmm. And what we have to have is a country and a society that says, you have a right to make a decision with your God, with your healthcare provider, with your family, and whatever choice you make, we should respect. But government should not be in the business of telling a woman what she should do with her own body.
But should businesses boycott this state? Should California boycott some of these states?
I think that we need to be very, very strong in our support of these women. And there are a variety of ways to do that. But first and foremost, let's make sure that we support the people who are on the ground there who are helping these women in a direct way. Because they need the support. They're working around the clock. Many of them are volunteers. And they need the support to make sure that these women are protected with their right to make their decisions about their own body.
Let's talk for a moment about the issue of gun control. You are supporting executive orders, potentially, to bring back the assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
Do you think that, as president, you would declare a national emergency when it comes to the issue of gun violence? Is that needed in this country?
Well, I'll first tell you that we, to have reasonable gun safety laws, is to understand that we reject the false choice that suggests you're either in favor of the Second Amendment or you want to take everyone's guns away. What we need is reasonable gun safety laws. Look, fine if you want to go hunting, but we need universal background checks. We need an assault weapons ban. We have so many tragedies that we have witnessed. And we've got to do better, and we can do better. And frankly, what is the reason why we have not? It's because Congress has not had the courage to act.
Right.
They've just simply not had the courage. And so I'm telling you that when elected, I am prepared to take executive action to do what Congress doesn't have the courage to do, which is, one, to put in place what will be the most comprehensive national background check requirement, which is that anyone who sells more than 5 guns a year, they have to do a background check on the person they're selling the guns to. I'm prepared to direct the ATF to take the gun licenses of dealers who fail to follow the law. And, Alex, you should know, 90% of the guns associated with crime are sold by just 5% of the gun dealers. They need to be out of business.
So would you declare a national emergency?
I'm going to take executive action to put in place smart gun policy.
So that's a version of that, I guess. Let's talk about the issue of education as
well,
something you're so passionate about. Probably talking more about that than anybody else right now.
That's right.
You're talking about raising teacher pay.
That's right.
In terms of the role of the federal government when it comes to education, some on the right say that education is better off when it's done at a real local level, local school boards, small local school boards, and that when the federal government gets involved, it's not their place. What do you say to that?
Listen, I actually am very supportive of, for example, what Governor Jerry Brown has done and then Governor Newsom has done in saying, look, local control is really important. It's good. I support that. I support the idea that local bodies will make the decision about where we're going to put the resources in school districts, emphasizing the school districts that are most in need. Also, I know that the federal government has got to do a better job of getting resources into the states so that we can improve public education in our country. And we have not had a national mandate around getting that done. And so I am prepared to put in place what will be the first federal investment in closing the teacher pay gap, which in California is about over $10,000 a year, meaning our teachers make almost a little over $10,000 a year less than similarly educated college professionals. And that's just not right. Mm-hmm. So I'm prepared to put in place an initiative that will close the teacher pay gap with federal matching dollars to the states. And let's be clear about this. $10,500 a year, which is the gap in California, that's a year's worth of mortgage payments in a lot of places in our state. $10,500 a year, that's a year's worth of grocery bills a lot of places in our state. And right now, we have teachers in California that are working 2 and 3 jobs to help pay the bills. Mm-hmm. That's just not right. In America, 94% of the teachers teaching in public schools are coming out of their own pocket to help pay for school supplies. We can fix this problem, and it is a priority for me that is a priority for our entire country. We will not be competitive. We will not be productive if we don't take this seriously and create a national priority around it. And it is also a moral issue. Mm-hmm. I strongly believe you can judge a society based on how it treats its children.
I always say the most important job other than a parent is a teacher.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I'm getting wrapped up. I wish I could talk to you all day. Yeah. I got to ask one fun question because we always do on our show,
yes.
Right? I know you love cooking.
I do.
And you love recipes. And
I
love Sunday night dinner.
I do.
So if the country was coming over.
Tonight, I'll tell you what I'm making tonight.
Well, what's your favorite recipe? Walk me through it.
Roast chicken.
Yeah.
And I do a variety of, I have a little herb garden, and so I like to kind of chop up the herbs and then chop up some garlic really fine and then peel a lemon peel, chop that up, mix it all together with some salt and pepper, tuck that under the skin of the chicken the day before.
Ooh.
Right?
You're really planning.
Oh, I'm serious. And then cut a lemon in half, stuff it inside, and then the next day roast that chicken. Oh, it's fantastic.
Oh, my God. I'm so hungry. Thank you so much,
You're
Senator
welcome.
Kamala Harris.
You're
Hopefully
welcome.
Next time you'll bring food.
Yes, right?
Okay.
Come over for dinner.
Okay, good to see you. Thank you. Our thanks to Senator Kamala Harris, and I hope that she will cook for me soon, or at least she'll give me her recipe. up next is a conversation with Gloria Allred. Gloria, as you know, is one of our most frequent guests here on The Issue Is. She always likes to dance with us. This week, she was in New York leading some of those massive protests of the issue of abortion rights. I don't know if you've gotten to see the movie Seeing Allred. It's really great. It's on Netflix, and it sort of tells the backstory of Gloria's life, which I didn't know before I saw it, because a lot of people think of her as like an ambulance chaser who does all these press conferences, but they don't really know the backstory of what made Gloria Allred Gloria Allred. And in this interview, we talk about that. We talk about her abortion. We talk about the fact that she was raped. And we talk about Roe v. Wade in an interesting way that may make you think differently about the issue. So here is our conversation with Gloria Allred. Gloria Allred. Gloria, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's talk for a moment, and I know it must be difficult to talk about, but a lot of people, I don't think, know the backstory for you of why this issue is so personal to you. And this week, you told that in a pretty emotional way.
Yes, I did, Alex, at a very big abortion rally, pro-choice rally, right here in New York City. And I wanted people to know, what is the impact on women and girls when it is a crime to have an abortion that is for a doctor to perform it? It is not a crime for a woman to receive it, but a medical doctor could go to prison for, in Alabama, up to 99 years if he or she is convicted of providing an abortion. And today, in Missouri, the governor signed a bill into law which would also provide for years in prison if a doctor performs an abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, if the pregnancy is 8 weeks or longer. And so what happened before Roe v. Wade, that U.S. Supreme Court decision, which legalized abortion and which essentially stated that states cannot make it a crime for doctors to perform an abortion at certain stages of a woman's pregnancy. Before that, for example, in the 1960s, when I was in my 20s, many states did make it a crime for doctors to perform an abortion. And I had gone on vacation to Mexico. I had met a doctor. We went on a date. And suddenly, at a certain point, when he said that he had to visit some patients who were in a hotel after having been released from the hospital, he took me into a room and closed the door, and suddenly there was a gun to my head, and I was raped at gunpoint. When I returned from the Mexico to the United States, I found that, in fact, I was pregnant. I had to get an abortion, and so I had to get it from a back alley abortionist. That's a person who was not a licensed health care provider, who was just doing it for the money in a bathtub. And I hemorrhaged and almost bled to death. He said, that's not my problem, after he performed the abortion. Then I was taken to the hospital, packed in ice with 106-degree fever. Fortunately, for me, I lived, but Other women were not so fortunate who had had back alley abortions, and so many women died or were maimed from illegal abortions. In the hospital, Alex, a nurse said to me, "This should teach you a lesson. I hope this teaches you a lesson." But the lesson that I learned from that horrific experience, terrifying experience, was that abortion should be legal, safe, affordable, and available. And now we're going back to the days. Now the anti-choice movement, what I call the mandatory motherhood movement, is attempting to have Roe v. Wade reversed by the United States Supreme Court and abortion criminalized again. And the people who are going to be hurt are going to be young women, poor women, rural women, and often women of color, because many of them will have to have the illegal abortions, and many of them will be possibly maimed or die or be forced to take the pregnancy to term. And that is wrong, and that is harmful to women.
What do you say to critics who say that life begins at conception and that you are murdering a child, you are murdering an innocent life by getting an abortion?
Well, you know, I respect the fact that they have their religious beliefs, which affect their judgment, and that they want their religious beliefs to be imposed on me and others who have different religious beliefs. But that isn't the way we should run our country. And it's not going to be a matter of abortion or no abortion, because women will always have abortions. It's going to be a matter of safe and legal abortions or unsafe and illegal abortions. And we just cannot allow women to be killed and to deprive them of the choice, and to have that choice made by governors who often will never have to have an abortion because they're older men or older women, or by others, elected officials who've never met me, don't know what's going on in my life or the lives of other women. And they can't impose, and they shouldn't be able to impose their religious beliefs on others who do not share those religious beliefs. Government should not be able to do that. We need to protect women. We need to protect our daughters, our sisters, our mothers, our aunts, who should have the right to choose and not put their lives in jeopardy.
Are there any restrictions that you would support?
By the way, Alex, I want to say, yeah, if I may just also say, there are many bills in many states that are being passed into law called fetal heartbeat laws, and they criminalize abortion or outlaw abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy. Well, that's absurd. First of all, a fetus does not have a heartbeat at 6 weeks. And secondly, many women don't even know that they're pregnant at 6 weeks. So the idea that they can have an abortion before 6 weeks when they don't even know that they're pregnant is patently absurd. So we have to cut through all this nonsense and just protect Roe v. Wade and protect a woman's constitutional right to choose abortion, at least at certain stages of her pregnancy.
Are there any restrictions at all that you would support on abortion rights?
I support Roe v. Wade, and I support the way it has a trimester approach to abortion. And it's based on a woman's right to liberty, a woman's right to privacy. And that's what I support, is upholding Roe v. Wade. I am very concerned about this United States Supreme Court, especially with the appointees of President Trump. I wish United States Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg a long life. And if, God forbid, there's any reason that she will be no longer on the Supreme Court for health reasons or other reasons, God forbid, then President Trump will, I'm sure, appoint another person to the United States Supreme Court, which will be extremist, a person who will, you know, reverse Roe v. Wade, which this would be catastrophic, Alex, for women and girls in this country. We're not going to stand for it. There is a war on women and our bodies in this country. We are going to fight this war with everything we have, and we are not going to allow Roe v. Wade to be reversed and abortion criminalized like it was when I had to get an abortion in my 20s.
So let's talk about that fight, though. What exactly does that look like? Some have suggested Hollywood should boycott the state of Georgia. Alyssa Milano suggested a sex boycott. What specifically would you like to see, or what do you advise people to do to fight back against these laws?
Well, first of all, we have to be ever vigilant. We should fund Planned Parenthood, the National Organization for Women, the ACLU, all of which are filing legal challenges to many of these laws, like the Alabama law, where Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit today challenging the Alabama law, and I expect that Alabama law to go up to through the federal courts, the United States Court of Appeals, potentially accepted by the United States Supreme Court. So we need to donate to those organizations which are fighting against these extremist and restrictive abortion laws. We also need to go to the streets. So we have to go to the streets and continue to protest these bans on legal abortion. And we have to go and be outside the courthouses, inside the courthouses, in the state houses. We have to elect pro-choice women and men to the legislatures. And most of all, in the next election in 2020, we need to elect a pro-choice president, pro-choice members of Congress, and do everything we can. Because, as I said on Tuesday at the rally in New York, no one has ever given women our rights. We've always had to fight to win them and to preserve them, and it has never been more important than right now.
Well, Gloria, thank you so much for sharing your views, and this is such a serious topic, but you know we like to have fun on this show, and this is the first time you've been on remote. Usually we dance in person, but I hope you can show us your dance move, if you don't mind, a little remotely. Can we see it?
I do the best I can.
There it is. There it is. Gloria Allred. You can't stop her. You can't stop her from dancing. Great to see you.
Now to another person on the issue of abortion, who's somebody you would not think would be sort of an ally necessarily of Gloria Allred, but on this one issue, there is some similarity. We're talking about Tommy Lauren, the firebrand Fox Nation commentator who is often controversial. This week she was one of the top trending topics on Twitter. When she came out against the Alabama law, you know, Tommy is pro-choice, has been pretty honest about that for years. It has caused some problems for her professionally. But she came out with this commentary. It got all sorts of attention. So we talked to her about that. We talked to her about immigration. We talked to her about presidential candidates. And we talked to her also about her new book. So here is Tommy Lauren.
Alabama's new abortion ban is too restrictive and will not reduce abortions, just make them more unsafe. And I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of heat from fellow conservatives on this stance, but so be it. I think for myself, and it's time for final thoughts.
Well, after that commentary on Fox Nation, Tommy Lauren became one of the top trending topics on all of social media. She's found some unlikely allies and plenty of anger as well. Tommy's here to talk about that and more. Tommy's also the author of a forthcoming book. Congratulations on that. Her new book goes on sale just in time for the 4th of July. It's called Never Play Dead, How the Truth Makes You Unstoppable. Tommy Lauren, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Good to be here.
Good to see you. So let's talk about your truth when it comes to abortion. For people that didn't watch the full commentary, what's sort of your main point?
Sure. Well, for me, like I've said time and time again, this is not new news. I am not pro-abortion. I am pro-limited government. And so for me, the government does few things well, including regulating health care. So I don't believe they should be included in making that decision. And also, when I talk to a lot of pro-life advocates, because I get that position, I really do, I often ask them, do you think a government ban, especially one like in Alabama that's a blanket ban with only exception for life of the mother, do you think that that's really going to stop abortions, or do you think it's just going to make them more unsafe, or they're going to have people traveling to other states or even other countries, making it, again, more unsafe for those women in that position? So that's the question I like to pose to a lot of pro-life conservatives. But the problem is that I seem to get a lot of tuning out from both sides. And that's the issue to me with this whole debate, is that we tune each other out and we don't understand that this is not a black and white issue for anybody, really.
Mm-hmm. You got some support from celebrities who don't usually support you. You got a lot of anger from some people on the right, a lot of whom watch Fox News. Mm-hmm. What was that like, sort of being in the middle of that storm?
For me, I never do anything or never strategize anything to get support from either side. One of the things I'm most proud of is that I get heat from the left and the right on a daily basis, and that's okay with me. I think for me, it's also important to stand up and say that there are pro-choice conservatives out there who feel like they can't say it because there is an attack, of course, from the pro-life community, and they don't even want anything to do with any conservative that is pro-choice. And I have an issue with that. I believe we can take things issue by issue and have disagreements and agreements on different things across party lines, because that's how most Americans feel. So why are we in such a polarized place where it's pro-life, pro-choice, Republican, Democrat? That's not how most Americans think and feel. So yes, it's great to get the support from the celebrities, but it's not really, to me, I don't look at it as support for that position. I hope that they look at it and say, this is a chick that's real, that believes what she believes, and whether it falls on the left or the right, she's going to speak her truth, and that's how I've always been.
Well, let's talk about something you have been advocating for that many celebrities don't agree with, which is the issue of immigration itself. This week in California, the state Senate moved forward with a bill that would give health care, access to Medi-Cal, to undocumented immigrants under 26 and over 65, who you would call illegal aliens. Mm-hmm. Governor Newsom was on our show last week talking about why he supports this. I know this is not something you support.
Well, absolutely not. I don't understand why we would be funding health care for those people who have no legal right to be in this country. We have an illegal immigration issue. Whether you're on the left or the right, I think we can agree that it's a problem. When you have thousands coming over a day, it's a problem. Cities are being overwhelmed with the immigration issue. And by providing more perks and benefits subsidized by California taxpayers, you're issuing a cattle call for thousands more to come into this country. And then I look at the problems we already have in California. I look at our homelessness issue. I look at our affordable housing issue. I look at communities that are already underserved. And then we have our elected leaders saying that they want to provide more benefits to illegal immigrants. That should be infuriating for Californians, no matter what side of the political aisle they fall on.
Well, speaking of California politics, we talked to Kamala Harris earlier in the show. She's running for president. As somebody who's a pro-Trump conservative, who do you think is the strongest candidate for the Democrats?
I think they're going to go with Biden because that's the comfortable choice. I think that if the economy wasn't doing so well, he might have a shot. However, it's really hard for Biden to come in and say he's for the working man and he's for the average American when Donald Trump is doing things for the working man and for the average American. If the economy was going down the tube, he would have a shot. But the economy is so strong, I don't think anyone can touch Trump right now, especially when they're just continuing with their witch hunt and they're not focusing on the issues.
Well, you know we like to play some games on this show. So one of them is the name game. We got a little Beyonce to get us ready for that. We'll take down this music and talk about the fact that we're going to go through all the different names of some of the candidates. So we want you to think of one word that comes to mind when you think of each of these candidates. You ready?
You're going to get me in trouble, but that's all right.
I know, but that's the fun part.
For you.
Okay. Joe Biden.
Sleepy. Obviously.
Bernie Sanders.
I call him Grandpa Socialist. That's just my name for him.
Kamala Harris.
Phony.
Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete.
Disingenuous.
Beto O'Rourke.
Robert. That's the first thing I think of. Robert. Robert O'Rourke.
Cory Booker.
Spartacus.
And Elizabeth Warren.
Pocahontas.
Well, that one was easy.
That one was easy.
Why do you think Mayor Pete's disingenuous?
Well, I think that when he hit at Mike Pence so hard over that issue, I felt like it was disingenuous. I feel like he had issues and then he had to go back to identity politics. That's really my issue with Mayor Pete, is that he had a platform and an agenda and then it switched all the way to the identity politics going after Mike Pence. And that's where he lost me.
All right, well, enough talking about everybody else. Let's talk a little bit about you, right? So we like to play a game called Personal Issues, where we get to know a little bit more about you and some of the stuff that you may not talk about in the commentaries to get to know who you are. So you ready? We're going to put 30 seconds on the clock. We're going to play our music. Here we go. And favorite movie?
American Sniper.
Favorite athlete?
Nick Boza, actually.
Favorite band?
Favorite band? Florida Georgia Line.
Favorite meal?
Spaghetti.
Favorite quote or motto?
Never play dead.
Favorite song?
Oh, well, you know, I'm such a Cardi B fan, so really, in any collection of Cardi B, I'm good with.
Do you have a favorite holiday?
Fourth of July,
Fourth
obviously.
Fourth of July is a great holiday, and Memorial Day, a great holiday as well.
Absolutely.
And we're all thinking about our troops as well. I know you and Cardi B got into a fight, so that was a joke for people that didn't recognize that.
I still like
that.
Her music, though. It's a joke,
but we do have another song choice that you made. Tell us about this. A little Up Down, right?
A little Up Down because Morgan's a friend of mine. I think he's great in the country music scene. He's going to be a big star, and he's always been so kind to me. So I'm supporting the new country artists.
So, Gloria Allred taught me a move. Do you have a move you want to show us?
I don't have a move, but I'm going to probably do on camera.
Can you teach me something?
I don't think I could teach you a dance move, but I could probably do hers. What was this? A little bit of this
was
hers.
Yeah, a little that, a little this.
I like Gloria's move.
She points.
Yeah, I like the pointing, and I like that. So I'm going to learn Gloria's dance.
We're bringing Tommy Lauren and Gloria Allred together. You don't get that on any other show. Tommy, thanks for being here. Nice
Always
to see you.
Always good to be here.
All right, how about that with Tommy Lauren? And finally this week, as we continue our parade of powerful women, we go to Jennifer Siebel Newsom, California's first partner, the wife of Governor Gavin Newsom. She doesn't do a lot of interviews. We've been asking to do an interview with her for over a year. She finally agreed to do one on the launch of her new film. It's called The Great American Lie. She had a screening this week at the Paley Center. She did screenings up and down the state to try to get people to see it. It's not in theaters yet, but she's trying to get a distribution deal. We talked to her about that. We talked to her about her job itself, why she calls herself first partner, raising four young kids in the governor's mansion. There's a lot to talk to her about, but though we begin talking about the film. Take a listen.
Jen Siebel Newsom, good to see you.
You as well, thanks.
So what is The Great American Lie?
So The Great American Lie is basically an unveiling of the truth that the American dream isn't the reality it's purported to be, that your circumstances actually are a determinant in your potential or the upside in life, that, you know, the zip code that you're born into, the family that you're born into can determine your destiny. So the American dream is, in essence, currently in modern day America, a lie. We are at a place where 0.1% of the wealthiest individuals in our country have more wealth than the bottom 90%. And the situation is so dire that we have more inequality than we had right before the Depression. And so this is leading to a crisis of connection, an incredible divisiveness in our country, and we have to do something about it.
So, what do we do about it?
So, the film really encourages us to look at our values and how we've gotten to this place. Where, you know, are you someone who leads with empathy, care, and compassion, or an orientation towards community? Or are you more individualistic, and do you kind of do everything just for yourself and your family? It's encouraging us to be more communal oriented and more empathic to those who are more vulnerable, who are marginalized, who are less fortunate than us. I like to say that, you know, some people are born on third base or in the ballpark, and others are born so far away that, you know, they're never even gonna have a chance to make it into the ballpark. And that's really kind of, the American dream is really about what can we do as individuals in our community, what can we do? I think we need now more than ever to have conversations with people that either appear different from us or are ideologically different than us, break bread, try and focus on our shared humanity, what we have in common versus what differentiates us, and try and build or bridge a path forward. And then lastly, we just have to vote our values at the ballot box, and we have to vote our values with our pocketbooks and support companies that are conscious or inclusive capitalists that actually produce products that have maybe a triple or quadruple bottom line. It's not just about money. There's a social bottom line, an environmental bottom line. So that's kind of, those are some of the solutions.
I imagine with the two runs for governor and the two runs for lieutenant governor,
yes,
as you're traveling around the state, you got to see that really firsthand. Was there a particular moment where you said, I need to make a film about this?
Great question. Was there a particular moment? That is such a good question. I started making this when I was making The Mask You Live In, And I intuit a lot of stuff, and I basically, while I was delving into the research about the boy crisis in America and how we're actually failing our boys and men, I knew that there were larger social, political, and economic ramifications of living in this sort of hyper-masculinist culture where we're privileging or elevating values such as power, dominance, control, and aggression at the expense of empathy, care, and community or collaboration. And so for me, it was more recognizing that these values were being institutionalized and harming not just the individual boys and men or individual women and girls like we unearthed in misrepresentation, but that they were harming society at large. And obviously, you can't live in California, you can't live in any metropolis and not experience or witness homelessness, right? Extreme poverty. You can't interact with immigrant communities and not see the obstacles on their path. But what's interesting in this film, though, is that we set out to make one film, and then 2016 election happened, and I knew that I had to turn the lens on the South and the Midwest, and so we went and spent time with characters, individuals in both the South and Midwest, and that really brought a whole new perspective, a conservative perspective to the story of social and economic immobility, and forced us to basically share kind of, once again, a path forward where we come together and focus on our shared humanity, our common humanity, versus what's dividing us.
There, even in these communities that are struggling, there are success stories. There are people that achieve the American dream. Why do you think certain people are able to achieve the American dream when so many other people are not?
No, great question. I mean, the statistics show, and Raj Shetty, who's this leading economist, again, is the one that came out with all of the research and data that proved that the zip code and family that you're born into being a determinant of your destiny. Only 7% of folks from the bottom economic quintile make it to the top economic quintile. However, the gaps in the ladder of our economic situation have gotten so wide that the people that are making it to the top economic quintile, they're not making millions of dollars, they're making $250,000. So it's not like, right, they've definitely gotten to a place that's much better than making $20,000 a year, or that that's what their parents made, but it's not that much, relatively speaking, compared to some of the wealth that we're seeing in this country. So obviously, to your question, it's hard work, it's being surrounded, having a network or somebody that honestly reaches down and helps lift you up and exposes you to their network and pays you a fair wage and provides you, you know, some of the things we're trying to do in California, which is like paid family leave and childcare and early childhood education, and address someone who, or a community that envelops you with supports so that you, and social services, so that you have a fair shot at achieving your potential. But it's really random, and it's not, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I think there are solutions when you look at the zip code and how we can kind of envelop certain communities and invest in them, but it's not like there's one solution for everyone, right?
Right. I've asked your husband this question, but I've never gotten to ask you this question.
Yes.
I think it's more interesting to hear from you. Why did you choose the title First Partner instead of First Lady?
Yes. So First Partner was really just a continuation of the work I've been doing at the Representation Project, which is about breaking down limiting gender stereotypes and norms. And to me, First Partner is both gender inclusive and gender expansive. So we will have a female governor someday, and we will have an LGBTQ governor. It's just a matter of time. And for me, also, partner and partnership is really critical to moving us forward, not just as a state, but a nation. We live in a very individualistic country. That's one of the kind of themes that comes out of the Great American Lie. And so for me, it's sort of putting out into the universe that if we move more towards partnership, we can solve some of these problems.
You've been really involved with a lot of family issues, a lot of strong advocate for women.
Yes.
How do you see this role? How do you see the job of First Partner?
I mean, I see the job as really a responsibility to help uplift women and families in California and ensure that the California dream is alive and well, and that women have the all the support, the economic support, the educational support, the care support, to have careers, but also raise healthy, whole families. And it's really exciting.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity, and it's one that I obviously take seriously.
And speaking of families, we were in Sacramento with you during the inauguration. We all got to see Dutch as the big star
yes.
of the day. It was just a reminder to me, like, I can't imagine being you
yeah.
with so many little kids. How do you do it all? How do you balance all of that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it takes a village. It's never pretty. it's messy, right? I think raising children is challenging for many people in that, you know, you and having careers or work at the same time. So there are a lot of humorous moments, you know, me walking out of the house into the office with, like, slippers on or, you know, having, you know, whatever it is. Like, I'm constantly juggling and, you know, but we have fun and there's a lot of laughter at home.
And last question, how has parenthood changed your life, changed your perspective on things like filmmaking?
That's a great question. Well, I think parenthood makes all people less selfish. I don't know how you can be focused on yourself and be a good parent. Like, you have to be other oriented. And so I definitely think, you know, I mean, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful because I didn't, you don't know if you're gonna have children or not. And so I just feel really blessed. And I learn from them all the time. It's very humbling, right? You see yourself in them and your own shortcomings as a human being. And you're like, okay, how do I help them not, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, it's like a mirror reflecting back to you who you are, the good and the bad and the ugly.
Right. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
I don't
know. Just real quickly, what is the Representation Project?
So the Representation Project is a social change organization that I founded after selling misrepresentation to Oprah Winfrey Network and basically recognizing that we had more than a film, it was a larger movement, that there was this demand for ongoing conversation and mobilization around the issues of the media's misrepresentations of women and getting more women into leadership.
Great. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so
I
much for the
it.
Time.
Yes,
I really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
And that's it for this week. Thanks to the first partner, to Senator Harris, to Gloria Allred, to Tommy Lauren, and to you for listening. Up next, a pretty exciting show. We're going to be broadcasting from the California Democratic Convention in San Francisco. They're going to have at least 14 Democratic presidential candidates. It's going to be wild. We've never seen anything like this. We're not sure who we're going to talk to. We're not sure exactly what's going to happen. But we do know that we're going to have a special show on TV from there and also more podcast materials from there as well. We're really excited for that. But we're really grateful for this show. And it was so cool to be able to showcase all these powerful women this week. So please subscribe. Let people know about this. Please talk about it if you can in social media because we're trying to get the word out that we have this show. We believe in it. We believe it's important to have these kind of conversations. And we're grateful for the chance to do so. So thanks for listening to The Issue Is. We'll see you next time.